Good morning. Other than the excellent emotional and intellectual support from my husband and family, I have no sustaining relationships or conflicts of interest to report to you. Someone else is delighted. I was delighted to be here this morning. So delighted that I wrote three introductions, personal, professional, and humorous, but we don't have time for any of them. So come and get my business card after this session, and I'll email one to you. Not necessarily the one you want, because I probably will have lost that one. Anyway, I will tell you a bit about the professional reason. To me, the most important thing that we do in public health is to develop and disseminate information to each other, to our target audiences, and we're always getting better at it. But our target audiences benefit only when they can use the communication effectively. The health literacy we require of them, however, encompasses far more than being able to read at sixth grade level and fill out a one-page form. As years of funding are pushing us onto the internet, even the basic requirements of literacy and perhaps of intelligence are changing. So I ask myself, what limits or facilitates information access? Given that social power affects how we humans access and use information, how are e-literacy and health literacy related to social power? Technology is increasingly important and related to social and educational change. So how does a look back at technology, literacy, and social change tell us something? The printing press and the internet were new technologies that had profound effects on access to information and social power. So the goal of this study was to look at the similarities and differences in the progress of literacy and e-literacy. My working hypothesis was that technology affects the dissemination of literacy, collective social power, personal empowerment, and therefore health literacy. By improving our understanding of these events, we can perhaps bring a new perspective to teaching health promotion and health literacy and health history. So this literature review covered social, historical, and health research because I like small, focused topics. And this paper is very, very preliminary. I hope it's the beginning of a longer discussion. So today, we will look quickly at the history of print literacy, which admittedly started a little before 1848, and its effect on social power. And we'll move then quickly to the introduction of literacy to oral cultures, the uprooted and captive slaves in the U.S., then to e-literacy, seeing some of the same trends and some new twists. While this stage of research doesn't really meet criteria for conclusions, recommendations, and impact on public health, I'll point out some themes that I see as affecting health literacy and the dissemination of health information, as well as some possible next steps, thinking about what we might learn from and teach about history and how we might apply that learning to our health policy planning. Since we don't have time for the dialogue that I promised, in the abstract, I have an internet-based approach if you want to join me in that discussion. We do have to neglect some things. You can tell here that I'm a maternal and child health epidemiologist. We have to neglect some things because of lack of time, so I won't be talking about education as a social determinant of health, about definitions and types of literacy. The components of health literacy, even though, for example, promoting social power and media literacy via the internet are very important both to health literacy and to the discussion of literacy as critical thinking, which I also can't cover. We won't talk about theories of learning, knowledge, and intelligence, such as multiple intelligences, even though I think computing by its very nature encompasses computational and visualization intelligence. We won't talk about research on the impact on education of the computer and the internet, although that's incredibly powerful. Theories or definitions of power, and we won't talk about education theories because I'm not an educator and you'd find me out. And of course, there's no time for structured interactive discussion, which I'll give you another invite about that later. Literacy and social power go together. The full quote, which I took from Elizabeth Eisenstein's book, The Printing Revolution in Early Modern Europe, is, "We should note the force, effect, and consequences of inventions that are nowhere more conspicuous than those three which were unknown to the ancients, namely printing, gunpowder, and the compass. For these three have changed the appearance and state of the whole world." We're going to skip this. You can look at it online. Elizabeth Eisenstein points out that the importance of the printing press and movable type, especially, to the Renaissance, the Reformation, and modern science. The Renaissance that succeeded, because there were earlier ones that didn't, saw the emergence of the individual, the artist, the writer, and the engineer, from a group of anonymous artisans. Printed books facilitated the cross-fertilization between philosophers and craftsmen that explains much of the transformation of the Renaissance. The Reformation and emergence of modern science were challenges to the status quo associated with the availability of multiple conflicting ideas. The 16th century Protestant and Catholic theologians' limited freedom of expression about religion repressed, the Catholic press repressed scientific discoveries, but the Protestant press published the works of mathematicians and astronomers. Also, publications preceded suppression. Galileo's Starry Messenger, published in 1610, made him an international celebrity. He was quoted in Japan several years later, before its banning and suppression. In talking about the Renaissance and Reformation and the transformation of science, Eisenstein stresses the value of placing many disparate texts side by side, never before possible, the increased number of observations and outlooks, and the coordination and cooperation, the tapping of many varied talents at the same time. The widespread availability of printed materials led to a drastic rise in adult literacy throughout Europe. The middle classes, of course, not the poor classes. And it made the gutter press and propaganda possible. Earlier duplication of ideas and observations had made literacy easier also reduced the reliance on a small number of carefully preserved texts. Perhaps the multiplicity of ideas and observations could then include fuzzy, wrong-headed, and misleading thinking. Now we'll fast forward to centuries, past centuries of literacy of rising middle class used to that the rising middle class used to wield, contest, spread, and limit social power. We'll ignore examples of scientists, authors, pamphleteers, and journalists, and jumped to the promised start, 1848, and its explosion of ideas about change and social justice. In 1848, African slaves in the U.S. had been learning to read for decades at least, often taught by white preachers. Only in South Carolina had outlawed reading or teaching literacy to slaves before 1829. The anti-literacy laws of 1829 to 1834 in six southern states occurred in parallel with revolutions and revolutionary social thinking in Europe and with the spread of literacy, numeracy, and Christianity among slaves, both in legitimate Sabbath schools and services and in some places and secret meetings called hush arbors, after the Indian brush arbor. Thus, learning among slaves involved conceptual changes, including Christianity, and slaves brought a new view of Christianity. Heaven meant going home, freedom, Africa, and salvation. Slaves learned self-actualization, too, a sense of community along with their letters. The legislation against slave literacy may have been preventive as well as reactive, or as much as reactive, by those who recognized the risk to their status quo. And again, there's that pitting, as there was in the Middle Ages, going into the Renaissance, of freedom of expression and suppression of that freedom, as freedmen recognized the possibilities of revolution. These are some of the characteristics identified with literacy among the U.S. slaves then. After the Civil War, the Reconstruction instituted a Freedmen's Bureau to meet the immediate needs of freed slaves, and it turned its attention to schooling within a year of its formation, actually rather than fulfilling the promise of helping the slaves' immediate needs. Freedmen went to school, from their point of view, to achieve practical power. However, the textbooks and curriculum focused more on social control than social power. Freedmen resisted the white education system because they wanted to stay with the black-controlled, well-developed school system, sometimes called the first school system in the United States, which offered, and that wanting to stay in charge of their own school system offended the well-meaning but rather paternalistic white northerners who came down to help them. And that movement of the Freedmen's Bureau overcame the black school systems that were in place. So now if we speed dial to the present, what do we find in the patterns that we've seen so far? The growth and development of the internet had a significant effect on health and healthcare, and we're starting to see a divide similar to the literacy divide that we've seen in printed material throughout the world. Enormous growth in the availability of information, disparate texts, many outlooks and observations, varied talents. So you see some of the themes and why I went back to the printing press. Self-actualization through both instruction and self-definition or blogging, expansion of knowledge and diversity of opinion about what is known, formation of groups and communities online, as well as limitations of access to this information because of lack of training, lack of access to technology, and so on. Now we have e-health, Internet 2.0, multiple sources of health information, web-based access to social and health services, and we have many of the same dynamics played out in this same forum. Burgeoning spread of contacts and information, along with moves to curtail access that might lead to social change, such as in China or North Korea. Moves, by the way, that didn't work any more than limiting the power of the press worked in the Middle Ages. Our use of the internet to overcome public health's increasing travel and budgetary limitations and to spread information quickly, cheaply, and effectively, but limited by the barriers to understanding and use of this new technology among our target populations. The growing faith in information on the internet and in our realization that our accurate information is in direct competition with well-presented, self-serving junk. And in addition to the growing split between the two groups that we might see as the web's high-fat, high-sugar content for the masses versus the sound information that we present but that is often difficult to find, we have increasing isolation from access to information, as I said, on the part of those who don't have access to computers, connections, or training. So the themes could be presented as self-actualization. I'll let you look at this for a second and skip over it. I think I've already said this. Health literacy on or off the internet is what we're aiming toward, and that requires increasing sophistication of our target audience. In its 2008 report, the Health Literacy in Canada, a healthy understanding from the Canadian Council on Learning, tells us that 6 in 10 Canadians do not have the skills shown here to adequately manage their health and healthcare needs. Canadians with the lowest health literacy skills were more, and you're going to hear some of the same themes, were more than 2.5 times as likely to be in fair or poor health as those with highest skill levels, much less likely to have participated in a community group or to have volunteered, more than 2.5 times as likely to be receiving income support. Health literacy skills were related to health outcomes at the population level also. The strongest link was with diabetes. Its prevalence declines as health literacy rises. So what do we take away from all of this? The value that we... What I think we take away from it is that we need to team with those whom we would empower so that we can teach them, so that we can make them health literate. We need to generate online communities. We need to build capacity in the target audience. We need to identify disparities and interventions to the target audience in a way that we that effect is effectively disseminated. And I'd like to see us learn more about and define 21st century learning. This quote, I think, is apt. So what are the limitations of this study? I found far more information than I could review fully and did not find some of the information that I hope to find about U.S. health literacy. I tried to eliminate or overcome some of my preconceived notions. Perhaps you can help me with that. And I'm running out of time, but I want to invite you, as I said I would, to join me on Wikispaces in what's called a sandbox to look at the 50-plus page bibliography that I've compiled to help me annotate it, to play around. You don't need to join Wikispaces to do this. You can just go onto that website and, you can just go onto that website and copy any part, access any of the other pages directly from there, modify, add, comment, initiate or join in a discussion, and please join me. Thank you.
No, I think the mood is out. Great. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here and to be able to speak with you about some ideas that I've tried out in a course that I teach at San Francisco State and that I've taught for the first time last spring, entitled The Necessity of Teaching the History of Public Health, or that's the title of this talk, but the course title, that should be the title of the course. But it's basically critical history of public health in the U.S. And so what I would like to do is run through the background of the course, my approach to the course, pedagogy, with definitely some critical pedagogical leanings, and also some of the resistance that I have found in students by teaching from a particular perspective, and also lessons learned and potential future directions. So let me paint a little bit of the contour. You'll notice that the screen is blank, so I'm being very transgressive this morning. I have no slides. So I'll try to be as descriptive as possible. If you'd like to turn up the lights, that would be fine. But in the interest of time, I'm going to continue. As I said, I teach at San Francisco State, and San Francisco State has about 29,000 students, who the average age for the students is 24, and there's a very, very we teach a very diverse student body, extraordinarily diverse, which makes sense for hopefully the comments that I'll be making in a bit. So the course that I'm teaching is a survey course on critical history of public health in the U.S., specifically to undergraduates. I'm now beginning to call the course the Impossible Dream because it covers and it demands so much coverage of so many topics, everything from infectious and chronic diseases to urban development, immigration, you name it. I mean, it's huge. But the impetus for developing the course was that there was no systematic coverage of public health history in our health education department. I teach within the Department of Health Education. And the primary mission of our department, our undergraduates go on to do community public health, so they're out in the field. So there was no systematic coverage of public health in both the undergraduate and in our graduate program, the MPH program. And also that the history department at San Francisco State, while once taught a seminar in the history of medicine, that was about a decade ago, and there's no history of medicine or history of public health being taught in the department. And so when I first offered my course last year, I found that there were about 75% of our health education students and about 25% or so of the history undergraduate students, and that comprised the course. What anecdotally, what's interesting, when I proposed the course back in the fall of 2007, of course it has to go through the various processes through the undergraduate, the department, and then the dean, and then the undergraduate dean, and I got a very swift email from the undergraduate dean saying, why on earth are you including the word critical in the title of your course? Now, I could take this one of two ways. One is we're well beyond this now and we're all critical, or that he clearly didn't understand, and I'm afraid I have to resort to the latter explanation. And so I fought with him a little bit. It didn't take much, but I did end up telling, kind of going through what it would mean to teach a course from a critical perspective, and I think he kind of got it, although I'm not sure in the end. At any rate, the title of the course has critical in it, which becomes extraordinarily important. As I said, the course is offered for the first time last spring, and it'll be offered once a year, hopefully every spring into the future. Now, in terms of my approach to the course, the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to set the tone for the course and ask students what have their experiences been taking history courses. And of course, I got a wide spectrum of answers, but mostly it was the standard. It was pretty boring, and it was taught from a very narrative, a very kind of chronological perspective. And so I thought that those are the answers that I might be getting. And so I wanted to use that as an occasion to talk about how history might be done in a new and perhaps creative ways. So, and because the other challenge that in my approach to the course that I faced was that many students are health ed students, besides taking the occasional general education survey course in history, mainly U.S. history, many of our students really were not that familiar with primary and secondary source analysis, and so I found that I had to engage them in a few exercises to kind of move that along, and so that was interesting, and it was a challenge teaching to both sets of students in a way. And ultimately what I ended up doing was pairing the history students with some of our health ed students, and in such a way as that my idea was that the health ed students could teach the history students about what's going on in public health, and that the history students might share some ideas about historical analysis, working with primary and secondary sources, etc. The other thing that ended up being a bit of a challenge in teaching this course, and by the way, the course was, as I said, is a survey course, and so it was kind of the impossible dream in some ways, but the whole notion of revisionist history, I had a couple of students be very critical, and not the good way of that term, but critical of the notion of revisionist history, and said, what are we doing here? And I tried to tell them and to teach them and hopefully to have them come along themselves in adopting the notion that revisionist history done responsibly is not only a good thing, but is even imperative in the work that we are doing, particularly around the issues of social justice. And we really, part of the mission statement, at least of our department, in training our undergraduate and graduate students, is around the issue of critical social justice and urban health. Then I have to go on and frame the issue of what it means to be critical, and namely, basically examining the intersections of race, class, sexuality, and gender, etc., in such a way that there would be, hopefully, to adopt the idea that there's more of an infusion of those ideas rather than kind of what I call the additive approach, just slapping, gender, sex, class onto those things when the foundation itself is pretty weak and inappropriate. So framing the notion of critical became very important and kind of anchoring the course. And again, it was a challenge. The other thing that I talked about in terms of the approach was the utility of studying and doing history from a critical perspective, that it's both a way of continuing work in the social determinants of health, but from a historical perspective, and also the notion of intellectual activism. And intellectual activism done in such a way as to not necessarily be endorsed or be separated from the academy, but actually that there's a blending of both activism, when people think of activism, activist out in the streets and activist in the academy, that those separations have often been false ones, and to really kind of look at ways in which our students can engage activism intellectually as and also out in the community, intellectually and how that manifests itself out in doing community health ed work. So what do I do in this course, in this general broad course? We should talk about pedagogy. I felt compelled, although I'm not sure that I would continue, to give 30 to 35 minute, what I call mini lectures on various topics, no more than 35 minutes. And then I would, very early in the course, have three students get into groups and select an article. They would go out and get an article, they would read it in common, and actually write a critical analysis of the article, looking through the lens of race, class, sexuality, and gender, to the extent that that's possible with the particular article, or a chapter of a book. And then each writes an analysis, a 3 to 4 page analysis of the article, and then they share it amongst themselves and actually comment on each other's work, and then end up producing a final paper on the analysis of the article or chapter of a book based on the feedback that they've received from the two other classmates. And I thought that this was a different way of, there was some resistance in doing this because isn't this cheating? That came up, this must be cheating. And it's standard, you know how it goes. Or if you don't, you would, or you will soon, right? So what ends up happening is that they then produce this paper, share it among themselves, and end up trying to produce as critical of a history or an analysis as possible with the special attention to these intersections that I've already mentioned. So that's one thing that I do in the course, one assignment. The other one is a film analysis, that there are several films that I show throughout the course, and I'm going to just call attention to one in the interest of time. But we view these films, and this one film was called A History of Sex in America in the 20th Century. And what I asked students to do after looking at this film is to write an analysis, again, using the lens of intersectionality and doing an analysis, and then not actually putting their names at the top of the paper, but some kind of symbol that only that student would recognize. So they write a nice paragraph, their analysis. We shift it around, pass them back out, and then I ask their classmates to comment on the analysis. Did they see something different? Would they support what their peer has done? How else would they view this? So that becomes an interesting exercise, and what happens is I either do one round of that or a couple of rounds of that. And then what ends up happening is it generates a very lively, and to use Dr. Moore's idea of a spirited discussion in the class. It becomes a very, very spirited time. So, for example, in this History of America, History of Sex in America, what we found is that, for example, when they talked about Margaret Sanger, she was hailed as the great birth control advocate, but not a shred was talked about the fact that she was a eugenicist, for example. They often talked, again, this film spanned the entire 20th century. The other thing that arose in this analysis was the fact that they would often picture African-American men who were in the Army in World War II going to the, going to the pro, as they say in the film, or the prophylaxis station, so they can be treated for the drip, you know, the clap. There wasn't a shred talked about Tuskegee, for example. No mention of that at all. So we get into these discussions about, I tell them in their and the assignment, imagine yourself a consultant, and you're a consultant who's been hired in, to give an analysis and input about what should be included in the film, what should be changed, how it should be changed. And it gets them to think very critically. And I've had a lot of success with that assignment. It's fun and generates lots and lots of discussion. And then there's the standard midterm exam. I don't want to tell you about that. It's the standard Blue Book history exam. A term paper, they produce a term paper, and the idea is that could be anything in U.S. history from the beginning time. Oh, that's okay. The beginning to the late 20th century. And they have to present that. It's an 8 to 10 page paper, and they have to really kind of produce it in a way that is that demonstrates a critical understanding of history. Now, very quickly, because I know I'm almost out of time, there has been some resistance to teaching in this way. Part of it is that students have this idea, even our students who tend to be slightly edgy, tend to want to be fed information, which is very, very standard, as you know, in schooling. Schooling has done a disservice to lots of folks. And also, the legitimacy of studying history from a critical perspective gets questioned. It goes against the grain of how history has been taught in general. So what are the lessons learned and future directions? I see zero up here. Maybe that can, I can talk about that if you want to ask me some questions later. Anyway, thank you very much.
I'll tell you, I promise.